Good afternoon. Today is Tuesday, May the 6th, 138th day of the new year. Joining us this afternoon, California tax preparer, Bill McCauley.
Hey, Brian, how are you?
Good. Did I give up your cheat sheet?
Oh, well, it's just some information I brought. Okay. That I thought might be more interesting than just, whatever was on
Travelogue?
The top of my mind.
Yeah.
I don't know, the travel was pretty cool.
The tan is fading, by the way.
Yeah,
I'll let you know it's starting to already come back to Humboldt County glow.
I know. Sad.
So you survived the tax season.
We did, yeah.
Good. Any surprises hiding in there or things that we need to be paying attention to? That is going to be the basis of this show. Ooh. Yes, the excitement builds and the tension will be relieved when we return.
From your trip to Latin America, you are invited to listen to the newest member of our radio family, 1790 AM, a Spanish language music station with sports from ESPN and news from CNN Español. If you own a business, invite Juan listeners into your business. For information, call 442-5744 or go to juan790.com. 1790, tocando lo que le gusta.
Good afternoon, KINS, News and Information Times, 313. Hopefully we're not boring everybody already in this show.
I don't think we've had a chance to do that yet.
Yeah, apparently some of us have. Our quote this afternoon, let's see, comes from, I got a Mark Twain. No, we did a Twain yesterday, but this is still pretty good. Or George Patton Jr.
George Patton Jr.
All righty.
Did George Patton have like five sons named George?
Yeah.
Like George Foreman?
Yeah, isn't that weird? quote, a good solution applied with vigor is better than a perfect solution applied 10 minutes later.
I like that.
Yeah. Can work.
Yeah.
Possibly. So what was the tax season like? What was in there that made this go around a little bit more challenging than what may have been anticipated?
Well, I think the big thing in terms of there's probably two primary areas that for our firm were the most consequential challenges that were kind of incrementally more difficult than previous years. The first one is that we have to wait longer and longer to get usable information for certain types of investment accounts. And so the brokerage houses have until the middle of February, where they used to be January 31st, to get their 1099s out. And even then, when they come out, they'll often say, well, this is subject to change, or, that this is not final.
They'll put an asterisk on it?
Yeah. And that becomes real problematic for a lot of reasons.
Those tend to be the more complicated returns,
they
I would
do.
Imagine.
They do, but they're not always, but a lot of them, but that it doesn't necessarily – there's not a complete correlation between the most complex returns and these types of 1099s. Now, your local broker has no impact on this. So, if you're going to see
Bob Smith.
Bob has nothing to do with this. Bob is stuck with what he's got, and I will tell you that Bob Smith and Joe Jones and everybody else, they're fighting the same problem. So this is not something where if you went down the street, you're going to find that it's significantly better at one location versus another. So this is not. I'm not intending to throw gasoline on the brokers in the community. We think they do a pretty good job in many cases, a very good job of representing their clients. But the point is that when you think back to just less than probably 5 years ago, the filing date for 1099s was January 31st. And then sometimes we got corrected 1099s, and we had to deal with that. But in general, most people had their 1099s at the end of January, maybe
early
February. Give
you another 2 or 3 weeks then to
exactly.
Make a run at it.
Now what we're seeing is most of those brokerage houses aren't issuing those 1099s until at or very near February 15th. Some of them not then. They're actually waiting going. And then the corrections are more rampant. So what's happening is you get the return done, and the client comes and picks it up, and they're filling out their e-file forms and getting them back to you. And sometimes when they bring the e-file form back, they say, oh, I got this form. And you look at it, and it's a corrected one. Well, now you got to go back through and redo everything. Worst case scenario is when those come in after the return's already been transmitted. And then you have to turn around and ascertain, does this mean we need to go back and amend the return? And that's a case-by-case judgment. But you do have to pull the file. You do have to look through it and understand what's changed. And then you have to, in turn, communicate with the client and say, look, this is what's changed. This is what we're seeing is the dollar amount that could be at issue. And, you know, do you want to proceed?
We're still friends, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, our clients don't really hold that against us. The concern we have, and in general we don't, you know, the amount we charge to amend a return is very small, if anything, because, you know, what we really don't want to be in is a position where our clients say, I don't want to file until the end of March. If everybody does that, we can't possibly service our client base. So it's a real problem, and so for that reason, in general, we just try to do the amended returns, you know, for the you know as low a price. We don't make any money on those things.
Push it out.
Just try to get them done,
yeah.
and you know, hopefully try to do them for as little or for no or very small fee to be able to do that relative to the cost of doing the original return.
Will the do-it-yourselfers be able typically to be able to do an amended return? Is it that difficult for those that tend to have the simpler forms? I don't know what could trigger it, but I can. I mean, you're talking, this is kind of dicey water. I'm thinking massive train wreck, bodies strewn, flames flying, if I tried to do it myself. Yeah. I mean, the magnitude.
I think an amended return is, you know, people who do their own return and they do them year in, year out, they get accustomed to the general format of how things happen. An amended return's a little different. So it's, you know, for somebody who has never done one, it's going to be a little bit of a head scratcher. That's not to say it can't be done, you know, that it can't be done by someone. I mean, it's problematic.
Most accountants want to pick that up in mid-stride?
You know, for most of us, we've got enough work that we really, you know, I mean, anything that feels redundant, you know, is frustrating because, you know, you feel like, you know, you're already, you know, it's backtracking. You know, it's, you know, I want to
sounds like my day
hands.
So far.
Yeah. Well, and so you can sense that kind of frustration.
It's 319.
Nearly half a century in the news business should count for something. I'm Dave Silverbrand, and that's how long I've been watching the world go by. Now it's time to put it in perspective. Join me each weekday for a look at local news and views and what they mean to you from my perspective. Dave's Take 2 on KWSW three times each day during the 8, noon, and 5 o'clock hours. Or read them on our website, kwsw980.com.
Good afternoon, KINS, News and Information Times, 324. We're back to Talk Shop this afternoon with Bill McCauley. So, Bill, you had mentioned that there was one of the challenges with this last tax cycle was trying to deal with the, I guess, elongated reporting period.
Yeah, and the compression. Yeah, it's really a compression of the window that we have available to get our work done.
Is there any talk about changing either condition?
You know, not that... You know, we must not have a very good lobby. Not that I'm aware of. I think that, you know, some of these things could be handled a little more sensibly. You know, we'll get a corrected 1099 and you look at it and you'll realize, okay, that's changed $13. So why is there no...
Why bother?
Well, either a why bother amount, an immaterial threshold, or if... Any amount, you know, if it's less than $1,000, we're going to roll it over and throw it on next year.
Yeah, it's kind of automatic handling.
So it just gets dealt with. It's like, oh, well, we didn't get it in this return. It's not going to be exactly right, but it's going to come next year. You know, there seems like there should be some logical way of doing it to reduce the stress that taxpayers feel trying to comply with this, to try to make people that have to, that have to help people comply with it, you know, that have chosen to, like the CPAs and other tax preparers, to help us be able to serve our clients without having to backtrack on things that are not very significant in terms of the dollar amounts in many cases.
Well, that's also not factoring in the cost of the government trying to chase down that $13 check.
That's exactly right.
Even if it's electronically, that's probably, 5 minutes of somebody's time that's a senior something at whatever level in the IRS to justify or to warrant. Well, okay, now you're chasing dimes, but you're spending quarters to get it.
Well, yeah, and you start thinking about, okay, what does it cost to process a check? You know, if there's a refund check or to process a check that's received, it costs something to do that. And so you do, you build it and all that in, you know, the systems have to be that much more robust to handle that kind of notice, of communication traffic and the notices that the IRS are sending out. So all those things make, it increases the workload at the IRS from a bureaucratic standpoint, and it increases the workload of the people trying to help people comply with those rules, and it increases the stress load for taxpayers. So it seems like there should be some reasonable ways of accommodating that. Now, whether or not that'll ever happen, that's a whole other matter.
I was going to ask if there, and I know the IRS is pretty tight. Well, of course, unless you pay somebody who knows what they're doing, then you get all kinds of information. But basically, the front door is fairly tight. Do you know, does anybody know how many, let's say, plus or minus $100 of those returns that are out of compliance, that are caught, how many there are, and how much money is spent chasing those things?
If somebody has those statistics, those are, as you might imagine, those are probably not statistics they want to be transparent with. But there definitely should be the ability to gather that kind of data and try to. Now, I do think that the IRS has some unpublished thresholds where they just kind of let things go. State of California, in many cases, seems to have anything under a penny they let go, but if it's over that, they tend to want to chase after it
And spend a nickel.
Oh, that, well, or spend $25 to get that, get that. The franchise tax board's a different breed of cat, and there have been discussions with Cal CPA Society and other CPA advocacy groups working with the state, trying to get them to be realistic about, okay, let's see if we can come up with some thresholds whereby you're just not going to pursue this,
some
because it's clearly
sense. Yeah.
Clearly doesn't make sense to do that. And I think that already occurs. That, you know, right now the government has, I'm not saying it does in California, but it does, I'm sure the IRS does have some thresholds like that, because when we do get correspondence about taxpayers, it tends to be, it tends not to be about $10 from the IRS. It tends to be about bigger numbers. So I think they clearly do, but they are not at, for reasons I think that are easy to understand, they don't want people to know what their threshold is for not worrying about it.
But it would, I think, if you get a return, you get the little postcardy thing that says you got a refund of whatever it was and you're supposed to hold on to it for next filing cycle. I would think on that they could say something about a similar concept. Appears as if there was an overpayment of, or an underpayment of, whatever the figure is. We'll credit that towards next year's. Yeah. If you want something to be done with it, make contact with us. Yeah. I mean, something really just kind of not hammer and tongue, certainly, just a notification rather than anything else. No action needed.
Yeah, I think the problem is less on that end and more on the uncertainty end from a preparer and a taxpayer perspective. I get a corrected 1099, and it changes the numbers $40. Okay, which means the tax on that might be you know, $10, picking a number out of the sky. Am I required to file? You know, is the IRS looking?
Yeah, when does an amendment necessary?
You know, why don't you give us a threshold and say, look, if the change in tax is less than X, don't worry about it. We're not going to worry about it. But there, you know, on the other hand, that might encourage people to go, okay, I know they've got a $200 tolerance, so they're always pushing building the $200 tolerance in their tax.
People do that?
I think Canadians do it. I'm not sure about
that. There you go.
I don't think that you
bang on the neighbor, baby.
Exactly.
It's 3:30.
The flame of learning is lit daily at St. Bernard's.
St. Bernard's has openings for new children in our preschool and pre-kindergarten classes. Hi, I'm David Sharp, president of St. Bernard's Catholic School. St. Bernard's Early Childhood Education Center, license number 12540-2277, offers preschool and pre-kindergarten. We're open year-round from 7:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. Call us at 443-7705 to schedule a visit.
St. Bernard's High School and Elementary School, making a difference in lives for today and tomorrow.
Good afternoon, KINS, Information Times, 3:35. We're back to Talk Shop this afternoon with CPA Bill McCauley. Bill, so we talked a little bit about some of the challenges. What were some of the tricks this year?
Well, I think the biggest single trick that we had for this year, the biggest single time saver that impacted tax preparation is a change that's occurred over several years. And when you look at clients who have securities and brokerage accounts, and some people have their investments in managed funds where there's a lot of transactions, and that transactional sales activity has been at times difficult and time consuming to deal with in tax returns. And what has happened is over the last few years, the IRS came out, it's been probably 5 or 6 years ago, and mandated that the brokerage houses would report sales of securities, and they would report, they used to always just have to report the proceeds, and it was a responsibility of the taxpayer to come up with the cost. Now, maybe the broker would provide it, but it wasn't going to the government. Now that information is going to the government. So the brokers are required to maintain cost basis records for securities that they transact. And there are exceptions, but in general, that's the requirement. It's been in place for a couple of years, and I can kind of explain that phasing in. What we're seeing is that reporting is making the tax reporting associated with those transactions easier.
Because they're having to do the compilation.
Because they're doing assembly of that data, and the format that it's coming in is more usable for what we're doing, and it's been a work in process. It's been a challenge for the brokerage houses to comply with this. This has not been something that's been easy.
How, I mean, it wouldn't seem like it would be that difficult.
Well,
but obviously it is, and these guys have got the fancy whiz-bang software programs and the computer analysts. So where's the challenge?
Let me give you a continuum of examples that might give you kind of easy and difficult. Let's say that I go out and I buy 100 shares of Redwood Capital Bank, and I pay X amount per share. 100 times X is my cost basis, and if the broker knows the day I bought it, what I paid for it, they have enough information to ascertain when I've held it for more than a year, so then it's subject to long-term capital gains versus short-term capital gains. And they know what I paid for it. Therefore, if I sell it, I would know they'd be able to tell me what the gain or loss is. That's
so
a
tracking thing.
That's the easy end of the continuum. But let's take my example and say that my wife and I buy this 100 shares of Redwood Capital Bank stock, and we buy it in year one, and in year five, I die.
Sounds easy so far.
My wife now, let's just say we're holding it in joint tenancy, so now my wife, or let's, you know, it's in a trust, doesn't matter. I mean, that the cost basis on those shares in a community property state. If you've got the right kinds of agreements with your spouse, is going to get a basis step up. So if the price, if the value of the if the shares have gone up by a certain amount in that time period,
because of the transfer,
just because time, 5 years has passed, they're now worth more. I die. There's a basis step up. So instead of what I paid for,
if you don't die, wouldn't there still be a basis step up?
Not if I don't die.
Why not?
Okay. So let me go back and okay. And when I sell the stock, if I sell it 5 years from the date I purchase it, I have a long-term capital gain on the different or lost on the difference between what I paid for it and what my cost basis is. Okay? My cost basis is what I paid for it in this example. If I die, I might get a step up in basis to the fair market value of the security as of the date of death. So if I paid $10 a share for it, and when I die it's worth $20 a share, then for my spouse, in my example, there's going to be a basis step up to $20 a share. And if she turns around and sells it a year later for $21 a share, she's going to have a $1 per share gain. Whereas if I hadn't died, we'd have had an $11 per share. So there's a wrinkle there. There's some additional complexity that you know.
But again, it sounds like it's tracking.
It's tracking and it's proactivity. In other words, it's very important then for the broker to know I died. And if for some reason they're not aware of that, they wouldn't know to change the basis in their records. So
it sounds like it's tightening the accountability of the brokers and the brokerages.
It is. It is.
Okay, so a little bit of a workload put onto them. But yeah. I would think that they're doing that kind of stuff anyway, but it's now being reported?
Yes. Now it's going to the government. So the government then knows these shares were sold on this date. It was long-term or short-term. If it's a covered security, which means it's covered by these rules, then they will report the cost basis to the government. And then they'll give you a schedule, and you can use that schedule to prepare the tax return for covered securities. Well, there's also other reasons. So let's go a little further on the continuum of challenge for the brokers. When if you sell a security at a loss but replace it within 30 days before and after that sale. So let's say I have shares and I paid $9 a share for them, and I sell them for I paid $10 a share for them, and I sell them for $9 a share. So I got a dollar a share loss. But if I replace those shares either 30 days before or after that loss transaction, it's called a wash sale, and you don't get to claim the loss. Instead, you have to adjust the basis of your shares. So the brokers have to know to allocate wash sale transactions to the cost basis of securities if there's been a wash sale type transaction.
But again, they're pretty accustomed to this kind of stuff.
Yes. But it's additional complexity. It's
and
another
it's the
layer.
Reporting of this that is
exactly
the challenge.
Yeah, I'll give you my final example. I buy a mutual fund. The mutual fund, for those of us who own mutual funds, your mutual fund pays out dividends throughout the year. Some of those dividends are ordinary income. Some of those dividends might be a return of capital, maybe a capital gain distribution. Some of them are non-taxable. So they pay out a small amount that's considered basically a return of my investment. The brokers need to adjust the cost basis of that security for that tax-exempt distribution. Now, think about this when you have one mutual fund. Not so difficult. Think about it when you have an account that throughout a year has 20 or 25 mutual funds with a lot of transactions. Again, it's adding complexity. So it was never... Some of the brokerage houses did a really good job all along, really kind of tracking this material but they didn't send it to the government. And the reports they gave to individuals were good, but they're not as good as they are now. Things have gotten better. So my point is, and my wife tells me I'm really good at making a short story long. The point is that reporting is making because of how it was phased in, we're now seeing that covered reporting on long-term transactions, which are transactions over 1 year from the date of purchase, between the date of purchase and the date of sale, we're now seeing those transactions occurring and being reported as covered, which the tax reporting is a little more simplified. Unless there's current year wash sales or some other things, there can be some other wrinkles. But
pretty much downstream is now benefiting from
it. Is
this.
It is, and so it was. It's been a long term project. And it's been with, I'm sure, a lot of pain back in New York with all these brokerage houses and, you know, dealing with it. And they probably hired a bunch of accountants and programmers to deal with the reporting issues. And so it's probably been, it's been a burden and a cost for those organizations to comply. But in the long run, I think it's gonna result in more accurate income tax returns and somewhat easier to deal with.
Well, and monster Christmas parties. Can you imagine computer techies and CPAs together in the same party? How excited. Yeah. Whoa. KINS, News and Information Time, 3:45. We'll be back with more from Bill McCauley.
Attention 6th and 7th grade students. Plan now to attend the Ideas at Work Middle School Career Camp at College of the Redwoods this June. Campers take part in fun, hands-on projects in high-tech labs, tour businesses, and explore careers. There is no cost for this camp, but space is limited. Learn more and apply online at decadeofdifference.org or call 445-7563. Don't wait. Sign up today at decadeofdifference.org and be part of it.
So far. Good afternoon, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 3:47. We're back to Talk Shop this afternoon with Bill McCauley. Bill, what lessons were learned this cycle through, things that we could, now that we're almost halfway into this year, incorporate into the current year that might save us some anxiety or some issues or consternation on your end of the equation?
Well, I think the key thing always... You know, procrastination tends to create problems. I think people who get started sooner, tend to have a more complete set of records. And it's as simple as, you know, if you're keeping track of things throughout the year, you don't forget, oh yeah, I did this and that, you know. I find people will come back later and they'll say, you know, the returns. And, oh yeah, I thought about this. I did that. Would that be deductible? Yes. Oh well, you know, it's probably not worth changing my return for that. Well, I don't know. We'd have to look at it. But you know, the point is, you know, if you are contemporaneous with your record keeping, you're much more likely to have, a complete record when it comes time to doing the tax return.
What justifies an amended return? Now, at what point do you say, you know, the train's left the station, I'm here at the station, bye-bye train, not worry about it, versus, you know, this might be something that we have to look at. What magnitude are we looking at?
Well, in general, if you owe tax, theoretically, you should file an amended return. I mean, if it increases your tax liability, you should be filing an amended return. In addition, if it changes a carryover, you might want to, you should file an amended return.
But we were just talking about those silly little thresholds.
Yeah.
I mean, $100.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't worry about it, candidly. You know, in most cases, I probably wouldn't worry about it. But, you know, I have some clients whose personalities are such that would bother them. So, you know, there's people we've done amended returns for that are relatively minor in amount because they're
just the right thing to do.
Yeah, for them, that's what they really, you know, feel is appropriate. And far be it from me to tell them that it isn't. I mean, you know, I can tell you that by the letter of the law, yeah, you owe an extra $10, you're supposed to file a return. Is that likely to generate correspondence from the IRS? I don't think so. But
what are the types of things that would trigger something like that? Well, are there some common things?
Lots of things. I mean, the sometimes people just forget information and it doesn't get in the return.
That would do it.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming by.
You bet.
We've been talking Shop with Colley. Join us tomorrow afternoon for more Talk Shop. Till then, go out and make it a good day. Hug someone you love. See you tomorrow.